Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, do birth control pills change women's brains? And first, Donald Trump's tariff policies. What are they and what will be their effects? Our guest host, Professor Doug Becker, explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Today we explore tariff policy in the U.S. and its global implications. Joining me are Eva Bozovich, who is professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. She's the author of Social Capital and Performance in Transition in Democracy, Trust in Transition, Social Capital in a Changing World. She also works as a consultant for international development organizations and their partners working on issues of private sector developments. And Louis Hebron, who is a training and development specialist for the Executive Management Program at Transcendent Solutions. He was previously the Associate Dean for Graduate Programs at Hult International Business School. He is co-author of Globalization, Debunking the Myths, and is currently working on a new edition. Well, welcome to this week's Scholar Circle. We'll start with you, Eva. Can you give us a little bit of a background into what we refer to as the rules-based trading order?
I think what you mean is basically the post-World War II trade order. And it's this idea that ever since the end of World War II, countries were really committed to creating a structure of rules that would guide their cooperation and prevent cheating, quote-unquote. And the rule-based order is really centered around a specific organization, now called the WTO. But back at the end of World War II, we only had the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. In 1994, the GATT was absorbed into a full-blown international organization. And the system that's centered around the WTO really relies on an important principle of non-discrimination or most favored nation status, meaning that any benefits you extend towards one partner are automatically extended towards all other partners, which has a brilliant reasoning behind it, in the sense that we don't have to negotiate bilateral deals that could get difficult and can promote difficulties in negotiation. Instead, we have one set of agreements that make it easier for countries to negotiate with multiple partners, extract benefits from one another, and hopefully lower barriers to trade over time. So I think it's important to know that the WTO was formed, GATT, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, was formed as a result of the Bretton Woods Conference at the end of World War II with the big goal in mind of promoting cooperation, preventing World War III, preventing another conflict, and in general, just encouraging countries to have an open dialogue, have a forum for negotiation rather than tit-for-tat policies in place.
And based on the international relations principle of what we call economic interdependence, or the principle that if countries are trading with one another, they're a lot less likely to go to war with each other.
Yes, absolutely. But I think it was also recognizing that in prior conflict, especially after World War I, it was extremely difficult for countries to resuscitate economic and financial relationships. In fact, some people credit the debacle of World War I peace as creating the foundations for World War II. And so I think it was really important for countries to establish principles for negotiation and openness in economic relationships, both to prevent conflict and also to form these interdependencies that would prevent incentives to go to war.
So Louis Hebron, it seems like what Eva is describing with non-discrimination is in many ways trying to take politics, or at least geostrategy, out of trade and encourage free trade. So what's been going on in particular with the president's proposals, and he's declaring himself to be a tariff man and increasing tariffs, and in particular targeting countries like China?
Well, let me respond to that by way of World Trade Organization. The reason why GATT evolved into World Trade Organization was because by that point in the early 1990s, 1994 specifically, most of the tariffs that countries had in place had already been reduced so low that there wasn't really so much need. I mean, yes, there still would be disputes, but for the most part, that wasn't the key center-focused anymore. And so hence, it had evolved into a World Trade Organization, and its main purpose is to handle disputes internationally among among nation states. In actuality, less than half of these disputes that are brought before this trading regime, it's actually resolved before it actually gets there to that point. You know, I mean, the U.S. may go ahead and file it, but during the, you know, even before it gets before the panel, it might already been resolved between the U.S. and Brazil or the U.S. and China. So having said that, what exactly is going on? Well, based on his statements, more accurately, his tweets, this current president doesn't seem to have a very strong handle of how trade works. In particular, can't get the right, it's actually was quoted somewhere, but I don't recall where. But in any case, he basically said along the lines of, we cannot continue to run deficits. That's no way to run a business. Yes, that is true. And, you know, coming from his business background and everything, you eventually do need, you know, to start having, making profits or at least have a balance. And that's locked in his perspective. The problem with that orientation is that a trade deficit is not really a very accurate accounting of what goes on between nation states. If I may use the analogy, on a weekly basis, all of us go to Safeway to purchase goods. We pay them with money. We get our goods, you know, produce, meats, whatever, and everything. And in that regard, we actually are having a trade surplus with Safeway or whatever else you choose, you know, Whole Foods and such. And nobody seems to have a problem with that. Why? Because much like in international trade, the value of trading comes in the consumption rather than in the production. That's actually one of the few quotes that I remember from Adam Smith from my macroeconomics class as an undergraduate. And so even producers are actually consumers. Okay? And so what ends up happening is that, yes, there currently is a trade deficit that the United States has with China right now. But that's actually a good thing. Why? Because that money that, for example, sells flip-flops to the dollar store, $40 million worth of flip-flops, that Chinese producer now can either hold on to it because it's one of the most stable currencies, but more often than not, they like to go and reinvest it elsewhere. And generally, the number one destination for investment right now is the United States. And that is excellent for the United States because business owners and factories and corporations that want to expand, they're now able to get at a lower rate, get those loans for expansion at a much lower rate.
Ivan Bozovich, what are the problems with a trade deficit? What sorts of concerns should the U.S. have if it's running a significant trade deficit against a country like China?
I really like Louis' analogy of going to the store and purchasing something. Just because I bought a sandwich at Safeway doesn't mean that I'm in a trade deficit. I exchanged money for that sandwich, but I obtained value, significant value in that sandwich, especially midday when I'm hungry. So I like the analogy that that's not necessarily a problematic trade deficit relationship where Safeway obtained my monetary value and I received sandwich value. However, critics might point out that it's one thing to be buying a sandwich when you have income. It's a whole another thing to be going into debt to obtain that sandwich. So if we could go back to the U.S.-China relationship, the problem might arise if we're continually funding our consumption using borrowed funds rather than generated funds. And I think this is the perspective of President Trump. He is concerned that we continue to go into debt in order to be purchasing cheap Chinese imports. But, you know, Louis is also correct. The other side of that coin, and they cannot be separated, there's two sides of the same coin, is that the funds that we are borrowing are financing tremendous amount of productive activity in the United States. So economists, when they look long term, ask the question or put the situation as follows. It's fine to be going into debt, especially when it's cheaply obtained debt. It doesn't cost us much. It's a very low interest rate or very low return rate. It's fine to go into debt, provided you're putting that money into productive use so that you're creating sources of income that will pay for those debts in the future, or they will be able to generate sources of funding from which we can repay those debts. So we have to ask ourselves, as an economy, are we putting that money to good use? If we're selling one-time real estate to foreign investors, that may be one perspective. If we're putting money into plants, manufacturing, research and development, job growth, that's another perspective. If we're just financing consumption of cheap products or overconsumption on clothing and services, is that a good thing? So the question of what is good spending is a more difficult one to answer. But it's we definitely need to think about the fact that the other side of this deficit coin is an influx of tremendous amount of investment, which is really good for our economy, provided we're putting it to good use.
Louis Hebron, we started off this conversation, and I referenced the rules-based trading order. Now, the United States has several outstanding complaints about China and violation of certain trade rules. Does the Trump administration have a point that there needs to be some sort of action to try to ensure that China, a newcomer to the World Trade Organization, having joined only in the mid-1990s, that China isn't necessarily playing fair?
Yes, absolutely. But they're focusing on the wrong, let me put it this way, they're giving the wrong solution to the problem. Every single nation state that's at the developing stage of their development puts up certain protective barriers on what's known as their infant industries, simply because they cannot compete with the more advanced industrialized states. And it's generally accepted globally that, yes, for a certain amount of years, until that particular industry gets on its feet, they're willing to, you know, to allow these protective barriers. Once they reach a certain point, however, when they are beginning to be profitable, and in fact can compete directly with the products of an advanced industrialized state, generally it's understood that then those protective barriers, or what's known as non-tariff barriers in form of subsidies that the government gives to these various corporations, then comes down. The problem with China, though, is even though it is now the third largest economy in the world, it still views itself as a developing country. And to a certain extent, it is, because of the huge population. And so instead of focusing on tariffs, you know, to get China to buy more goods, what the United States needs to focus on is that China needs to start removing these barriers, all right? And these would include such things as, for example, in order for an American corporation to invest in China to set up a factory, it could only own 49, at most, it can only own 49% of that factory. The 51% belongs to a Chinese corporation. Other areas include industrial spying. The reason why China's been able to move so quickly in such a short period of time is, quite frankly, they've stolen most of the technology and innovation, not just from the United States, but from the West. There is actually what the focus should be. In terms of trade, generally the law of supply-demand, if you leave it well enough alone, it normally takes care of itself. Consumers will buy what they want and won't buy what they do not want or need, and producers will act accordingly.
Eva Bozovich, there's some legitimate concerns with China and trying to bring them more appropriately into the rules-based order as a developed country. And Louis, you had mentioned they have the third largest economy. I do believe they passed Japan and they're second now. So to even reiterate that, if the U.S. was particularly concerned with trying to confront China's trade policies, why then has the Trump administration decided to single out a number of trade allies? I think of the NAFTA allies, Canada and Mexico, and European Union countries, when it would appear strategically it would make more sense to bring trade allies together and provide a united front against China.
So that, and it's not entirely clear to me, and I'm hoping that maybe Louis has added insights on this, but I think if there is a way to put them together, it would be to suggest that there is a broader strategy by the administration to upset this rule-based system in order to extract better terms from its trade negotiations. And so one way to possibly think about this is that this is a way for United States to really show how dissatisfied it is with the WTO framework and to kind of force the hand of the international community to make the difficult changes that need to be made within the WTO. WTO is now almost too big for its own sake. It includes virtually, I won't say all of the trading world, but a significant portion of the trading world, which is a lot of partners who, like Louis said, don't have much to go in terms of lowering barriers. What's left is really so-called deep trade issues. These are regulatory issues, things like subsidies, state-owned enterprises, e-commerce, labor standards, environmental standards. So these are issues that have implications for trade, but they're almost slightly removed from trade. So it's very difficult to negotiate these things within the WTO. And also the very issue that Louis mentioned of who do we call a developing economy? Are BRICS economies developing economies, given how much economic and political power they've gained in the last decade or so?
And by the BRICS, you mean these emerging economies, Brazil and Russia, India, China, South Africa?
Correct. And so perhaps this is a way for the administration to break down this, maybe break down the rules-based system, or at least force it to make the difficult changes that need to be made. So I don't necessarily think that our strategy with China is the same as our strategy with Canada, Mexico, and the EU, but it's part of a broader tool set that the administration is using. So the similarity is not in terms of goals. I think the similarity is in terms of the tool set to which this administration resorts. And like Louis, I would also suggest that this tool set is a little bit inappropriate for the goals that the administration is trying to achieve.
Now, Louis Hebron, I mean, both of you have said you think this tool set might be inappropriate, but the president has certainly turned to some decisions made at the most recent G20 meetings in Argentina, that the ceasefire in the so-called trade war and some recent developments between President Trump and President Xi. Is it fair to say that this president, who is particularly transactional, likes to win? Has he won this one?
It depends on how you define win. I mean, in all likelihood, I mean, he gave a 90-day window, and there's no way that the negotiators are going to be able to iron that out within 90 days. And Trump right now has two things going against him. First is the already aforementioned not clear understanding with regard to what tariffs do. But just as importantly, he now is much weakened with the House of Representatives now. You know, granted, it is the Senate that will approve these treaties and such. He still has the majority, but he's going to get a lot of pushback from the House. But just as importantly, Xi has more or less declared himself emperor for life. So he can basically wait it out, you know, for the next administration. Now, having said that, we do have to give Trump some credit, because this situation has been going on, you know, all the way back to the Clinton administration, and no one's actually called China on it. And so there was actually bipartisan support, I believe it was either back in April or March, where both the majority leader and minority leader in the Senate, so it would be Chuck Schumer, supported, you know, that actions need to be taken with regard to China. Now, expanding on what that question that you posed to Eva about NAFTA and the EU as opposed to China. NAFTA, for all of the complaints, actually has been very, very successful. And one large indication of that is that there is now more Mexicans leaving the United States than actually coming into the United States. Now, part of the reason for that is because the vast majority of them are farm workers, and because of innovation and advances in technology, you know, they're not needed as much. But just as importantly, because of NAFTA, they could now actually find jobs in Mexico as opposed to having to come to the United States.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I am Doug Becker, and we are discussing the ongoing trade war between the U.S. and China. Joining me are Eva Bozovich, who is professor of international relations at the University of Southern California, and Louis Hebron, who is a training and development specialist for the executive management program at Transcendent Solutions. He was previously the associate dean for graduate programs at Hult International Business School. So, Eva Bozovich, Louis just mentioned NAFTA. Very recently, the president has announced that he has blown up NAFTA and has a new U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. Is that what happened with these negotiations with NAFTA? Or what is the status of what he calls the U.S.-MCA and what the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau insists is actually just new NAFTA?
So I would say that most of the folks who have, look, most of the think tanks who have compared the two deals would not say that this is a brand new agreement or a destruction of the old agreement in any way. I think the consensus out on the street is that this has been a small change in the existing agreement, and that it's quite appropriate to call it an updated NAFTA or a new NAFTA rather than a brand new agreement. So I think that's a little bit of branding that the president is doing as a whole, and I want to return to this point of branding it as a brand new agreement in order to post a win. I want to relate that to some other deals that he's been doing. But to give you a sense of the new NAFTA, there are certainly some provisions that are significant. So the United States did manage to get a significant win in terms of us getting access to the Canadian dairy market. So there was a segment about a 3.5% of the Canadian market that U.S. farmers can now target, which in dairy world is probably a significant win. Another difference in the agreement is that whereas before the local content requirement was 62.5%, meaning that all the vehicles eligible to be imported tariff-free have to have been produced up to 62.5% within the NAFTA countries, now this has been increased to 75%. And what this means in real terms is that manufacturers can now source less or fewer of their parts from China, Japan, and Korea, and they have to source more of their parts from Mexico, U.S., and Canada. So these have been probably the more significant changes, but I would also like to say, and I don't think that this is getting a lot of coverage, I would like to say that Canada scored a huge win. And of course, we don't write about it because we care about U.S. wins. But Canada scored a big win with the removal of the Chapter 11. And Chapter 11 dealt with ISDS, or investor-state dispute systems, which were provisions in the old NAFTA allowing private corporations to sue states that enact policies which negatively impact their profits. And one of the significant losers of ISDS cases has been Canada. Canada has paid the most in terms of money owed to private corporations that have sued Canada over its regulations, mostly due to environmental standards. And so the fact that Chapter 11 was now removed from the new NAFTA, I think, benefits Canada. United States has never lost an ISDS case. Mexico has paid a ton, and then Canada has paid a ton. So I think this has been a significant win for Canada as well. So our big win is dairy. Their big win, I would say, is Chapter 11. So in those terms, I would say those are the big changes. Everything else is quite similar, which is why people say this is just a revamped NAFTA, an area where the agreement did add some new details, which was much needed, and everyone was looking forward to this part, is to spell out regulations or terms that will regulate the trade in e-commerce, data localization, issues that have to do with the new forms of trade, e-commerce. And so this has been beneficial. And I think another significant impact of the new trade deal, which ramifications of which we'll see in the future, is there's been added a new provision in this deal, one we have never seen before. And that provision says that member countries are not allowed to sign new deals with non-market economies. And I think this is a total dig at China. This is really supposed to prevent Mexico and Canada from forming side deals of any kind with China. And it seems like this provision is one of this administration's favorites because it's starting to appear in drafts of other trade agreements. So in that sense, I hope I gave you a little bit of insight as to what's new and what's old. But most think tanks are rating this as an update of the old, which is probably why Canadians keep referring to it as the new NAFTA. Now, I want to return to this broader point of president liking to score wins. That's certainly the case with NAFTA. He likes to brand this as a destruction of the old agreement, which was the, I believe he called it, the worst deal ever signed in the history of the world, or some kind of quote like that. And so he really wanted to make sure that his supporters know that he's been looking out for their interests and that he has signed a deal which will, quote-unquote, bring the jobs back to the United States, although no one really expects that to happen. So there's something similar happening with other deals. We signed a revamped version of our free trade with Korea, and again, it made slight changes, but it was branded as a brand-new deal, which is going to sell more vehicles, more U.S. vehicles to Korea. The way they accomplished that is that they raised the Korean limit on how many vehicles they will import from the United States. But they're already importing less than the current limit, so raising that limit doesn't really change the actual number of vehicles being imported into Korea. But the president has termed this as a significant win because it's going to allow more vehicles to be exported to Korea. So that's been another example where we call it a win, but it's really just a slight change to the wording, and some experts say it won't even make any real impact on the actual trade flows. Another example of calling it a win when it's not really clear what we're accomplishing is that we were in the process of negotiating something called a TTIP between United States and European Union. TTIP was significantly challenged by the Brexit situation, United Kingdom choosing to exit the European Union. So that put a significant damper on negotiations, but then President, when he became President, said, we're not going to negotiate TTIP. And yet, the truce this summer in our fight with the European Union includes some of the very terms that we're being negotiating under the TTIP in order to show the president that he can score some easy wins and kind of leave the Europeans alone. And so it's another example where we're professing to be doing something new, but we're really just doing the old stuff in a new format.
I do want to return to U.S.-European trade relations, but before we leave Asia, and by the way, I agree with you about political wins. I think the emphasis, for instance, on Canadian dairy, which may not have a profound impact on the entire economy, but should have a pretty significant impact on an important state in the 2020 presidential election in Wisconsin, for example. So how much of trade is driven by political considerations. But when that comes to mind, Louis Hebron, I think of TPP. And Eva had raised some issues about U.S. trade throughout Asia that not directly with China, but she had mentioned, you know, Korea and other Asian economies that are growing so rapidly. And the fundamental foundation of President Obama's so-called Asia pivot was these trade relations and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But of course, the U.S. withdrew from that. So what is the U.S. doing vis-a-vis trade now that it is withdrawn from the TPP and trying to attract closer trade relations and investments coming from Asia that's not necessarily China?
It is focusing specifically on bilateral trade agreements, which is actually a bad thing. One, because you actually have more leverage if you are part of a larger trade group. But secondly, and perhaps even more significant, is that the United States basically is giving up an opportunity to help write the rules for the larger trade within Asia. And not only is it giving up, you know, that opportunity, but it's basically handing over to China the ability to put its stamp print on it. You know, because generally the way this works is that while it benefits all, it has a tendency, and most of these trade agreements does have a tendency to benefit the largest, the hegemon, if you will, within any of these trade agreements. And so, yeah, it literally handed it over to China. If I may expand on what Eva had said about NAFTA, it's interesting that she chose to speak specifically about South Korea. South Korea now has a particular fondness for BMWs. And BMW actually is the largest importer of automobiles from the United States. In fact, they want to expand yet further with Spartanburg, South Carolina. And so, you know, it's no accident that that's one of the key focuses of this tweaking of NAFTA, which actually it is. It's not a totally new agreement, but rather like in most relationships, you examine it, you know, every 5, 10, 20 years or whatever to see what areas need improvement, what areas can be eliminated and such. But, yeah, bottom line with regard to the TPP is that the United States really needs to get back in there. They need to get back into the game so that their interests can be heard. Granted, it is an economic community, but as in most of these, the larger the state in terms of their markets as well as their investment capabilities will have the largest imprint.
And, of course, China's reaction to, in some cases, U.S. withdrawal from the region. They were doing this prior to the U.S. withdrawing from the TPP, but sort of serving as a counterweight is the so-called Belt and Road Initiative. China trying to link the region in trade, but link it directly to China. And so how much is the concern about the trade deficit or in general just economic relations between the U.S. and China really not as much an economic concern, but more of a sort of a geostrategic? China is the country most likely to challenge the U.S. leadership in the region and even perhaps, you know, globally, and that the U.S. is driven perhaps even more so by a means to try to cut off some of China's growth more so than it is trying to promote U.S. economic growth.
That's precisely what's happening right now, that even though it's coming in the form of economic investments and placed within the context in the economic realm, actually these are all geopolitical moves. China basically now has set up bases all the way from the Arabian Sea to the South China Sea where they can take care of their ships in terms of if they need maintenance work, if they need to have fuel and such. And moreover, these various countries are now beholden to China based on their investments. You know, Sri Lanka, for example, was not able to, the relationship was set up was that they would, if they can't meet the payments on it, then that base would belong to China, or that export processing zone would now belong to China. I mean, it'd be a long-term lease, but China, it literally becomes a de facto Chinese entity. And that is what this whole Belt and Road thing is all about. And the United States really needs to pay more attention to that in that it is a geo-strategic strategy rather than a geo-economic policy.
So, if I
may add to that.
Yes, please.
I would say that, well, by the way, Sri Lanka lost the port, and I thought it was very kind of symbolic that China now owns the port for, I think, 91 years, and isn't that the same terms of the lease that Hong Kong was under for 91 years? So there's some symbolism there. Now,
yeah, they bought a timeshare.
So something that I would give credit to the administration for actually astute maneuvering, I would say that they are paying attention to that geopolitical strategy and that they are using these economic deals to accomplish the larger geostrategic goal, much like the TPP was the tool of the Obama administration for the Asia pivot, forming economic ties in order to dampen the influence of China in the region. I think the administration is trying to do that with outdated tools. And like Louis said, they're using bilateral deals rather than multilateral deals. From the standpoint of domestic objectives, I think the president prefers the bilateral strategy because it makes him look tough, and it has a much better sell domestically than the TPP. I think he read the tea leaves correctly, knowing that the TPP would have been an uphill battle at home. It was going to be very costly to the U.S. consumers, and with the globalization backlash and the rise of populist politics, I think he read the tea leaves and decided there's no way that TPP is going to fly at home. So why don't I appeal to the base and get out of the TPP and now try to accomplish the same goal by using bilateral deals? And you can see that he's already started talks with India, South Korea, even the Philippines and Vietnam. There are talks in place to do each one of those member countries with a bilateral deal, to cover each one of those countries with a bilateral deal rather than the multilateral TPP. And Louis is correct in pointing out, I think, that these multilateral deals actually give you less leverage, in the sense that what's left to negotiate are things like subsidies, state-owned companies, wages, bargaining power of workers, anti-corruption policies, environmental standards, telecom rules. Those are not the things that countries want to negotiate typically on a bilateral, in a bilateral agreement, because all United States has to offer in return is more market access. Countries feel a lot more comfortable changing their rules and changing their domestic policies and standards, knowing that other similar countries in their region are going to do the same as a result of signing the multilateral deal. So I think U.S. will have a hard time pushing countries to negotiate these type of deep trade policies only in exchange for deeper market access on behalf of their exports. And in that sense, it might create some ill will, because countries will be almost, they will feel pushed into it rather than part of a collaborative agreement, in which case we may get a coalition of coerced rather than a coalition of the willing, if it comes down to this broader strategy of cornering China.
It seems from this conversation that multilateralism in trade has come under fire the last couple of years, and there's been much more of an emphasis on bilateralism, much more of an emphasis sort of bringing in geopolitics, bringing in geostrategy, and tying trade pretty directly to the relations between two nations, which is precisely what the rules-based trading order that was created at Bretton Woods at the end of the Second World War was meant to avoid. Is the future multilateral or is the future bilateral?
You've hit on something that most people are not focusing on, is that the World Trade Organization could be the biggest loser in all of this. Because if it is shown that it is not able to resolve these problems, to basically allow nation states to get away with these unfair trade practices, a la tariffs, then it loses credibility as the protector of this rule-based system that's been in place, since the end of the Second World War. And so therein lies the biggest danger. And part of the problem is that the World Trade Organization is basically a court system. And even though, for the most part, complaints have been resolved, it takes so long. The United States they've won as much as they've lost. And when I say lost, when a complaint has been brought before them. The World Trade Organization, for the most part, is doing its job, but it's taking so long that the confidence among nation states is declining. So during the point where it's still being adjudicated, there's another 2 years in which this unfair tariff is put into place. And countries have noticed, yeah, they're willing to. I'll be able to get away with it, and then later on they'll say, okay, you've ruled on it, we'll make our changes now. But they've, gotten 2 years since it was filed, and who knows how many years before that, of unfair trade practices.
And Eva Bozovich, I'll give you the last question then. Is what's going on with respect to international trade and the Trump administration, is this a new trend within trade relations, or is this a bit of a blip that's tied to the presidency, the current president?
Well, from the grand scheme of things, it may not be entirely new. I think in terms of the backlash against globalization, we've seen this before, and we've seen catastrophic consequences of policies that countries have taken. So in the interwar period, we've seen a United States resorting to the Smoot-Hawley tariff in order to protect its economy against what they perceived an influx of cheap imports, and also to score significant political wins. And, you know, a lot of economists now seem to think that our use of the Smoot-Hawley tariff actually prolonged the Great Depression. And so the scary scenario is that by using these type of tit-for-tat policies, we're going to encourage countries to respond in kind, in which case we may provoke a broader global recession, which will not benefit any of the main trading partners. I would also say that I somewhat disagree with you that there's a trend now in the world economy to resort to bilateralism rather than multilateralism. I think this is a peculiar U.S. objective. I think other countries may be still resorting to multilateral trade negotiations, maybe not of the type through the WTO, for the very reasons that Louis was pointing out, but there is still an in-between strategy, which is regional and cross-regional trade agreements. And I think other countries are very willing to sign regional and cross-regional trade agreements, as exemplified by the TPP, TTIP, RSCEP. So there's a lot of big mega-regional trade agreements that are in play. So I would say that this return to bilateralism is a very, I would say, the U.S. thing. And I'm worried about the overall consequences of us provoking other trade players to resort to tit-for-tat policies.
Well, thank you very much, Eva Bozovich and Louis Hebron, for sharing your expertise on this increasingly important issue. And it's certainly, this is an ongoing political trade drama that I'm sure we're all going to be paying very close attention to. Thank you.
Thank you.
Eva Bozovich is professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. She's the author of Social Capital and Performance in Transition in Democracy, Trust and Transition, Social Capital in a Changing World. She also works as a consultant for international development organizations and their partners working on issues of private sector development. Louis Hebron is a training and development specialist for the Executive Management Program at Transcendent Solutions. He was previously the Associate Dean for Graduate Programs at Hult International Business School. He is co-author of Globalization, Debunking the Myths, and is currently working on a new edition.
When we come back, how are birth control pills changing women's brains? Stay tuned. You're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Hormones change our brains, according to neuroscientists. What might this mean for women taking birth control pills over the course of their childbearing years? What might these changes be? Belinda Pletzer joins us. She researches neuroendocrinology at the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Salzburg in Austria. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you here with us. Perhaps where we could start then is actually what the chemicals are in the pill that are having the brain effects. So I've read that the pill actually has multiple chemicals in it. It's not just estrogen and progesterone, and they're finding that these, they're androgens, anti-androgens, and they're having different effects on the brain. So maybe we can start with actually what is in the pill?
Most pills that are on the market and are most commonly taken are compound contraceptives. So they contain both an estrogen component and a progestin component. And mostly the estrogen component is ethanyl estradiol. It's a very potent estrogen, so it has a higher binding affinity to the estrogen receptors than our natural estradiol. And it also has a longer half-life, so it stays in the blood longer than our natural estradiol. So that's where most of the contraceptives are, or at least most of the oral contraceptives, the pills, where they are similar. And what they differ, it's the progestins, because there's many, many different progestins on the market. And as you already mentioned, some of them are androgenic and others are anti-androgenic. Some of them, mostly the older ones, like levonorgestrel, for instance, they were derived from androgens, from 19-nortestosterone, which is a very potent androgen. Researchers have been also, doctors have been trying to get rid of these androgenic properties and make newer progestins. That's why the newest progestins like trospirenone, they don't have these androgenic properties anymore. They are actually anti-androgenic.
So the androgen, anti-androgen properties are the things that are actually changing women's brains that you found, right? Or is it all of the chemicals?
It's all of them. I think that the ethanyl estradiol also has a very strong effect, and that it's very hard in the compound pills to distinguish which effects are attributable to ethanyl estradiol and which are attributable to the progestins. So one approach to that, to this, would probably be to compare the androgenic and anti-androgenic ones, and where they have similar effects that could be from the estradiol, that if they have different effects, that could be from the progestin components.
So what are the things that you have found in terms of the way the brain changes?
I have to say that all the results we got were from between subject studies. That means we compared a group of women on the pill to a group of women who are not on the pill. And it's possible that the effects we found are not hormonal effects, but that women who take the pill differ from women who don't take the pill in other aspects. Like, I don't know, social status sometimes, or maybe even personality. So for instance, what influences your decision to take the pill or not to take the pill? However, I think that since most of our subjects were student and matched in those respects, I am hopeful that that was not the case. So what we found in the first study was that the women who are on the pill have larger gray matter volumes in several brain areas, including the frontal cortex, hippocampus, parahippocampus, and also the cerebellum, for instance.
So before you go on, can you tell us what those would actually have in terms of effects? Like, so what if you have a different hippocampus?
Hippocampus has been implicated in memory, of course, and also in spatial processing, navigation, for instance. Also, the parahippocampus has been implicated in navigation. And the frontal cortex is relevant for tons of things, verbal processing, for instance, emotional processing, inhibitory control, etc., etc. But again, one has to be very careful to conclude from a structural study what the functional implication would be without actually testing that.
Let's go back to these changes then. So you're finding the changes in all these different areas of the brain. And I think I read that it seemed to be masculinizing women in terms of the brain structure. Is that true?
No. Our first interpretation or our first approach was to compare sex differences, so the differences you usually find between men and women, to the differences we found between contraceptive users and non-contraceptive users. And in terms of structure, you have both, because women usually have the higher frontal cortex, whereas men usually have the higher hippocampus and parahippocampus. And if both those areas get larger in the contraceptive users, then you have both effects. But later on, we did a study with two number processing tasks, where we also compared men to women who don't take the pill, and then women who take the pill to women who don't take the pill. And there we found that the differences between men and natural recycling women were actually very similar to the differences we found between natural recycling women and women on the pill, and that women on the pill don't differ from men in their brain activation patterns.
One of the other studies you did actually even looked at how menstrual cycles affect the brains. And so it seems like the pill is affecting the brain, but so is the fluctuation, the normal fluctuation of hormones.
Yes. What you would expect, of course, is that the hormones, the synthetic hormones you have in the pill affect the same brain areas and the same brain function as the natural hormones do, because they bind to the same receptors in the same areas. So that's what you could expect. And for instance, the hippocampus also changes along the menstrual cycle. It's larger in the pre-ovulatory phase when estradiol is high. And the pill also has a high amount of the potent ethanyl estradiol. So that's not so surprising that that would also change. We also found that the hippocampus is larger the longer women have previously been using the pill. So even if they are not currently on the pill anymore, the longer they have previously taken the pill, their hippocampus is still larger.
So in terms of the changes, it doesn't necessarily snap back.
I'm not very comfortable speculating on that right now, but yeah, that's one of the indications that made us wonder whether it would snap back, and gave us the idea that that would be something worthwhile investigating, whether it's actually reversible, because before that, I think everyone was just assuming, yeah, those effects are temporary. But then if the duration you have been taking this before still affects your brain when you're not taking it anymore, that there might be something lingering, yeah.
So we know that the brain has some plasticity, but we don't know yet how much that change can go one direction and another. I mean, if you think about it, if a woman's menstrual cycle changes her brain, I suppose then you would expect it to then change back, but then...
Yes, it changes back. So if hippocampal gray matter volume increases pre-ovulatory, then it decreases again after ovulation. But that's short-lived. I mean, the pre-ovulatory estradiol peak is only for a day, and then it's gone. And that's different than taking the same amount of estrogens day after day for years.
And so generally speaking, we know also that when women's hormones change later in life, that affects the brain.
During menopause, when you lose your estrogen. Yes, I'm not a menopause researcher, but I know people who do that. And menopause, I think it had a research interest peak a few years back, and now it's re-emerging, basically. Probably due to the findings on the pill, I don't know. But I think it's an excellent model. Also, any time of hormonal change in a woman's life is an excellent model to study what sex hormones do to our brain. And yet, I think that also for these researchers, the hippocampus is one of the areas where they also find the most interesting effects, like a smaller hippocampi with the loss of estradiol.
So would you say that your findings suggest that the pill may not be brain safe?
No, we don't have enough data to say anything like that. And I would really not want my findings to be distributed that way. The only thing that's important to me is that we should start looking what it does to our brain, because it's a very, very important effect that has been ignored for 50 years. So we need to know that in order to be able to make an informed decision about our contraceptives that we use. I think women have a right to know that.
And there are multiple kinds of contraceptives that you noted.
Yes.
And some are going to have these effects, while some have maybe a different kind of effects.
That's one of the difficulties also, that if you study one contraceptive and you find some effects, then that might not necessarily mean that all other contraceptives have the same effect. That makes it complicated because there's so many different brands on the market. And as a woman, you should ideally know about all of these brands before you decide which one you take. So there's a lot of work still to do, figure out what they all do.
Do you have a sense that your work is changing how we look at contraception?
Yes. I think that at least among sex hormone researchers, the pill is becoming a more and more interesting topic to study, also among brain researchers. And since we did this first study, the structural study I told you about, there's been a lot of other research groups starting to work on the pill. And I think that's a good thing. It's important that we start looking into what it does in our to our brain. I'm not sure about the public. I mean, there was a lot of public attention to these studies, naturally. I mean, women are interested in what pills do to their brains. And it was, the reactions were quite different. Some thought, oh, my brain areas get bigger, so the pill is a good thing, so I should be taking the pill. Whereas others were, oh, the pill changes my brain, that's a bad thing, so I should stop taking the pill. And I can understand both reactions, but I still think that at the moment we can't make any of these claims because we don't know the functional significance. Also, it was a between subject study. There might still other factors explaining our findings. I mean, we did a follow-up study where the effects were actually much smaller. We still found them, but they were smaller. And also in the frontal cortex, the effects were in the other direction. So it's possible that different populations of women react differently to the pill. That's also something we have to still investigate, figure out the factors in a woman's life that make her susceptible to changes.
What are your next steps in your research?
Well, I want to get away from this between subject designs. I mean, it's easy. You just recruit the women off the street. Because it's a huge experiment running around and I don't have to do anything, basically. They just come into the lab. Now I want to get away from this and I want to capture women when they start taking the pill and when they get off the pill and also get a more detailed history of how long they have been taking the pill, et cetera, et cetera, which is not that easy anymore because you actually have to, find them when they start taking them. And if you also want to control which types of hormones are in the pills they start taking, they often they don't know yet when they decide to go on the pill because they first have to meet their gynecologist and they don't know which brand they will actually be taking.
Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you very much.
Belinda Pletzer researches neuroendocrinology at the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Salzburg in Austria.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible.
To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin,
Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.